Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to the FDH Lounge and our 10th anniversary celebration with the greatest honor we could possibly have. For the seventh time, we are being graced with a visit by one of America's premier legends, Bob Barker, and I, Rick Morris, as the managing partner of the FDH Lounge, am very pleased to be able to say that. We first caught up with Bob on his book tour in 2009 for his memoirs, Priceless Memories, due to some great guest booking by Steve Cervillo with Bob's longtime right-hand man, Henry Bollinger, himself one of the great public relations men in Hollywood. I've always prided myself on my preparation for any conversations. You do the homework, get in there, and hope for the best. In terms of the best, it doesn't get much better than leaving a good enough impression for this very generous man to give us some more time repeatedly over the years. Now, with the 10th anniversary of our initial broadcast on January 14th, 2007 upon us, an inquiry was made about having him on to share this moment with us, and having that granted was a priceless honor indeed. Every time Bob comes on, I try to have some opening notes that do justice to the occasion, but I don't like to be repetitive, and I believe they call something like that a great problem to have. In assembling my notes for the show this time, I thought of that great internet meme that has a picture of something and it says something along the lines of, you may be cool, but you'll never be this cool. One of the best examples is, you may be cool, but you'll never be Elvis Presley practicing karate cool. Well, I think the same concept applies here. We all crave validation in the work that we do. It's fundamental to how we operate as a species, but people may validate you in your work, but you'll never be validated like being granted a seventh conversation with Bob Barker. And I cannot even find the words to express how much I appreciate that. And all I can say is, for the seventh time, come on down, Bob Barker. How are you today, sir?
I want to congratulate you on your 10th anniversary.
I really appreciate it. It's been a long and winding road. Not nearly as long and winding and accomplished as the career that you've had, but that's a tough standard for anybody to try to live up to. But just having you back with us is just absolutely amazing. And of the number of things that I jotted down that I wanted to be sure to talk to you about, I want to harken back just recently here, Bob. I was thinking of you on election night and feeling kind of sad when I saw one of the returns come in. I know that Congressman David Jolly down in the Florida 13th Congressional District is a friend of yours, somebody that you've cut ads for. And in a country that's got as much gerrymandering as we have, there are so few races that have any real drama to them anymore out of 435 seats, but that was one of them. That was one that really kind of swung back and forth. And I got to say, too, I'm also not a big Charlie Crist guy, so I was also saddened to see the governor make it in for that reason. But that was one where, again, I was thinking of you on election night, Bob. Your guy gave it a very, very strong run, though.
Well, he did give it a strong run, and I didn't participate this year in any way, so I can't be responsible for his defeat.
It's not on you. I love it. But all the same, I know that you've been close with him and the congressman that he used to serve, the great Bill Young, back in the day. So,
Yes. Bill Young and I were friends over a period of years. Bill helped us a lot with some of our animal legislation and various things. He and his friends were really close friends with me. I've enjoyed them all.
Yes. I know that your background with him was very strong because of those issues. And, of course, every time we've had you on, you kind of hinted at it right there in terms of talking about animal issues. There was something that I was reading about with you that was from a perspective that I had really never thought of before, really kind of innovative. What you're talking about with some of this work with PETA here, when you were lobbying CBS vis-a-vis animal treatment issues, and that instead of having animals in captivity for entertainment, using computer-generated images of them, using the CGI instead, if you have to do this, use it in a way where no animals are being utilized. I had never thought of it from that perspective. I was really kind of blown away. How much traction are you and PETA getting with this kind of movement?
Well, I think that they're using reproductions more and more. I like to say that if you're in a movie and they use real animals, it's because they're not spending any money. They're not. It's a cheap movie. You don't want to star with animals.
Yeah, get an actual budget behind it, and you know that would allow for the bypassing of animals to be used in that way. I know that one of the times that you were on the show previously, it of course came right on the heels of that horrific Zanesville animal massacre when the private zoo got let out and the animals were scattered all over the place, and a lot of them had to be put down. And I know from that point in time, Ohio has made progress in reining in that kind of stuff. And you were speaking with great authority at the time on how many of the states at that point, as of the fall of 2011, were very deficient. Have we seen any real kind of movement on that in the last 5 years, Bob, as far as states catching up to this and perhaps using that sad example as a reason to want to get serious about it and avoid those kind of problems?
Now, you're talking what particular – I've worked on so many campaigns.
Oh, sure.
What
sure.
campaign
well,
are
specifically,
you talking about?
Regulation of private zoos, Bob, and really kind of getting rid of, because it was, I know it was kind of like the wild, wild west from the way you were talking about it in Ohio in 2011, and that's how that was allowed to happen here. And Ohio has since tightened up since that time, since the horrible incident down in Zanesville. But have you seen more of that happening across the country? Are states getting
more serious
about reining in this kind of stuff?
More and more zoos. Certainly the better zoos are They're veritable. The animals are not caged continually. They don't spend their lives in some small cage. There's plenty of room for them to get out, and it's more like a sanctuary. And if the animals are always in cages in a zoo, you can make up your mind you're in a badly run or a zoo that is not sufficiently doesn't have enough money to really operate, and it's depressing. If you go someplace where you can see animals in a natural habitat, then you can enjoy it. But I can't stand zoos. I can't go in one.
Yes, and that is that's a very good point there. And a lot of these places trying to operate on the cheap. And once again, animals kind of taking the brunt of that. I know it's slightly belated here, Bob. We're about a month out from it, but I wanted to wish you a belated happy 93rd birthday. And,
can you believe it? I can't believe I'm 93 years old. It hadn't taken any time at all to become 93, it seems.
Well, it's one of these things where, Bob, I have to say, as it got late in the year in our culture, we were kind of holding our breath about a lot of our great legends, because 2016 was just a brutal year from start to finish for a lot of our biggest legends in this country going down, from Muhammad Ali to, at the end of the year, Debbie Reynolds and Carrie Fisher. And again, you were definitely somebody who has trafficked amongst the legends over the years and known some and made some friends. Were there any friends that you lost among some of our greats that passed from the scene in 2016?
No close friends, no.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that it has been a bad year in that department. And I was listed, I saw a thing just the other day where it was listing some of the oldest people in Hollywood. And, of course, I was right there with my 93 years. But I found it was more stimulating than being on the other list.
Well, we all know you're going to be on that list for years to come, Bob. You're going to be right up there. And I know that that's the thing in terms of tying it to the animals. That's been something we've kind of talked about previously. But I know that you've expressed that your work with PETA and with other such causes, that has been part of the vitality that's kind of kept you going. And I can relate to that. I think a lot of people can, that you know, the notion of just kicking back, laying on the beach, and kind of just, you know, living off a lifetime of memories. The people that do that don't tend to make it. The people that stay active and invest themselves in it are the ones that really kind of keep going. So how central has some of the PETA work and some of the other interests in your life been to maintaining this ongoing longevity?
Well, I think that, first of all, I am a vegetarian, and I think that's important. And secondly, I work out regularly, and I think that a diet and old and exercise are two very important ingredients in having a pleasant old age. And then, of course, I am indeed deeply involved in the animal rights movement, and it is such a we're having so many successes, and I've seen such great advances in it that it's certainly been good for my health, I will tell you, because it's so rewarding. This animal rights movement is, I describe it as being like a huge snowball rolling down a mountain, and it's just getting bigger and bigger and moving faster and faster all the time. And over my lifetime, I've seen great advances, and I hope to see many more.
Well, you've been responsible for a lot of them, Bob. No question about that, because I'd mentioned to you off air about finding your first Price is Right show from 1972 on YouTube and watching it. And as you had commented to me, that the pacing was a little bit different because it was a half hour, so there was that. But one of the biggest things on there that you saw that you would never see today was, of course, one of the prizes being given away being a fur coat. And that would never happen today. And you raising the awareness of issues like this is the primary reason I think that would never happen today.
Well, I played a part in it. I asked Price is Right to take the fur coats off, and they did, and I was most grateful. And then, if you will recall, I used to do the Miss USA and Miss Universe pageants, and I asked them to take the fur coats off the show, and they didn't do it, and I resigned.
Well, you have to be able to take a stand.
That got a lot of publicity at the time.
Sure. It's
somebody
described
it. Somebody described it as a situation where the fur was flying.
Yes, figuratively,
I wanted
probably
to
literally
fly out, and they didn't do it, so I split.
Well, a very principled stand to take, and I know that people respect you for that and for the awareness that you have raised on that issue. And in terms of taking principled stands here, on a somewhat lighter note, a question that I have to ask you, I know that you as a lifelong Cardinals fan were probably rooting for my team, the Cleveland Indians, in Game 7 of the World Series, but the arch rivals, if you will, of your Cardinals, the Cubs finally breaking that curse going back to 1908. So I'm just curious, you being a Midwest guy over the years, you must have known a lot of Cubs fans. As a Cardinals fan, is there room in your heart to feel good for the Cubs and for their fans and what happened here, or is it just a sense of not wanting to see the arch rival team do it?
Well, I must confess that I was very pleased to see the Cubs do get it done. They've been long and patient, long waiting and patient. But as far as the Cardinals are concerned, my interest in the Cardinals started when I was a kid. I lived in Springfield, Missouri for a period there, and Springfield was a Cardinal farm club there. And kids could join the Knothole Gang and get in free. And I lived in South Dakota, but I went down there every summer with my mother, and we visited my grandmother. And I went to every ball game. I learned all the Cardinals' names, and then some of our players from Springfield went on up to the big club. Stan Musial played there at about 15 minutes in Springfield, and he was up there. But I became a Cardinal fan, but now I'm out here, and I have been here for so many years that I must say that I like to see these teams out here win now. And I still wish the Cardinals well, though, don't believe. But I knew them when they had the Gas House Gang, and oh, they were colorful. Dizzy Dean, Daffy Dean, and the Mutual came in later, and They were a great group. They really were.
Absolutely. And I have to say, Bob, you were probably, I'm sure you were happier at the end of the World Series than I was, since my Cleveland Indians have remained now waiting since 1948. But I'll tell you what, I have to say, because you touched on it briefly there about seeing Stan Musial back in the day. You might have given us maybe the greatest guest anecdote in our 10 years the last time you were on when you were talking about this, because it just really, if you frame it the way to think about this as three great American legends, but thinking back to when they were anonymous, when you mentioned seeing Stan Musial down there in the minor leagues before he was known as Stan Musial, and then subsequently getting to see Frank Sinatra barnstorming through the Midwest, I think you said on his first tour, the notion of Bob Barker still anonymous, getting to see these other two future legends still anonymous, is maybe the greatest story that's ever been told on this show.
Well, thank you. I have been fortunate in seeing some of the greats move along in sports of all kinds, and I've enjoyed it. When I was a kid, I wanted to pitch for the St. Louis Cardinals. That was my dream. And I went to St. Louis. I've forgotten what I was doing there. I was doing some kind of a show. But in any event, Whitey Herzog was the manager of the Cardinals at that time, and he had heard about how much I admired the Cardinals, and he invited me out to the ballpark, and he gave me a Cardinals jacket and a Cardinals bag, and I wore that jacket. I still wear that jacket, and I carried the bag to the show every day until it absolutely fell apart. So I'm known as a Cardinal fan still.
Absolutely. And, again, a great organization, perennially way up there. A rare thing this year for them not to make the playoffs, but they have been right up there, and they have maintained their excellence as one of the historically great franchises in the National League. And, again, I know that you have a lot of great things to look forward to with them, with their sustained excellence and some of the young players that they continue to develop there. And they have just been a model franchise. So that's the kind of franchise that anybody would be fortunate to root for. But in terms of other matters, historical, something else I had alluded to you off air was I had just come across this recently. There was a great story in the Wilkes-Barre Times Leader, and I know that some other publications have written about this, the approaching anniversary, 60 years to the date, of what will go down as the first pre-recorded show in TV history, Truth or Consequences, getting to do that. And I was reading about that. I was kind of amused when you were talking about the circumstances of it, of having to do that from the Pacific Coast at like 8:30 in the morning and an audience that wasn't properly into it at that hour. And it's something you'd prefer to do with a midday crowd. And about the handicaps of doing the show at 8:30 so it could be 11:30 on the East Coast. That was kind of interesting as I was reading about that. And, again, a big piece of TV history that you were a part of there as Truth or Consequences really kind of revolutionized TV in that way.
Well, it certainly did. And you're right. We were doing Truth or Consequences live at 8:30 in the morning. And this was my first national show, and no one knew who Bob Barker was or anything about him. And we were doing it here at I can't remember the name of the building now. It's still there, and they've changed the names about three or four times. But in any event, in the marquee where we were doing it there at this theater, on the marquee it said, "Free Donuts and Bob Barker." And that was when I was first doing the show. After a few weeks, Ralph Edwards told me, "Well, you're my man. It's gone splendidly, and you're here to stay." And I said, "Well, then, may we please change it to Bob Barker and Free Donuts?" And so I got top billing over the donuts, and that was my first step into stardom.
Bob, that's something the rest of us can only dream about, is getting our name above three donuts on a marquee. I'm not there yet, but I hope to be there one day.
Well, it took time.
Yes, nothing happens overnight. And I have to say also, too, on further reflection of something you were talking about a minute ago here with the history of the Cardinals organization, I hearken back to an appearance that we had on the show in the last couple of years here. A gentleman named Larry Matisic, who was involved as a broadcaster and a promoter. I don't know if you were aware of this or not, but in the 50s and in the 60s, the Cardinals had a lot of involvement with some of their personnel. Joe Garagiola went from being a broadcaster to doing broadcasting work on something called Wrestling at the Chase. They would do this thing in St. Louis where they would have wrestling, pro wrestling, from a fancy ballroom at the Chase Hotel. And that's where they would tape the TV shows and just the sort of outrageous scenery of it all happening there. I know that we've talked about it previously when you were on the show, being on The Price is Raw back in 2009 with the WWE. So the St. Louis Cardinals have their own history here. And it seems that a lot of great institutions, whether it be the Cardinals or you, intersect with pro wrestling at some point in your life.
Oh, pro wrestling, it played a very important part in my life. When I got out of the Navy, and I was a naval aviator, and when I got my wings, I got married. Everybody did, all the pilots. We got leave, mm-hmm. and we all went in different directions and got married and brought our wives back with us, and they were with us for the remainder of our training. But in any event, when I got out, I had another year of college to go, and before I got my first job in radio, my father-in-law was in politics there in Springfield, Missouri, but he also promoted wrestling matches, and I ran the concessions at the wrestling match, wrestling matches for him, and I saw all the wrestlers on their way up, like Gorgeous George. You remember Gorgeous George?
Yes.
He started, one of his first visits was right there to Springfield, and several of the ones who went on and made it big in wrestling. So I have participated remotely in the wrestling scene.
Well, Bob, you know, you'll probably get a kick out of this then, as far as the way that the wrestling business generationally kind of recycles itself, because again, there's only so many original ideas in the world, right? So as far as characters and all that kind of stuff, one of the guys who's on the WWE roster now, a wrestler named Tyler Breeze, he's doing like a supermodel type gimmick where he holds up like a selfie thing here and it gets broadcast on the Jumbotron and he's primping and he's posing for it like he's a male supermodel. He has explained in interviews, he got that from watching Gorgeous George clips on YouTube. He was looking to retool himself. Nothing he was doing was working. And he looked at it and he said, what if I tried to do Gorgeous George for the 21st century? And he's basically made it stick. So, you know, it's nice to see the great ideas like what Gorgeous George was doing get recycled and made current, Bob.
Oh, yes. Well, Gorgeous George was very early in his career. No one had heard of Gorgeous George, and he used to come through Springfield there occasionally, and he was great. He brought that audience alive like no other wrestler of his time. He was a real powerhouse.
Absolutely, a real pioneer and a giant in his industry as far as lending the kind of pizzazz that we would come to know today with it, a real revolutionary figure in that. And again, I think such terms would also be used to describe you in American life, Bob. I think undeniably one of the great American legends of the 20th century, and it has just been a privilege to have you on the show, as we have on these couple of occasions here. And as I indicated to you off air, that you know, our Hail Mary pass that we threw was to try to get you as the keynote guest for the 10th anniversary, get you back on, and I am grateful beyond words that we were able to do it. I thank you so much, not just for this conversation, but the six previous, and look forward to the next one whenever we're able to make it happen.
Well, I'll look forward to it too, and thank you for your very, very flattering remarks.
I appreciate it, Bob. It's just an honor and a pleasure to have you on. And again, it's just an outstanding segment that we're able to do, and I'm forever grateful for it, for you. And also, please thank Henry Bollinger again for me as well. So thank you, Bob, for being with us today. And thank you, everybody in the audience, for checking out our 10th anniversary show on the FDH Lounge.
Happy anniversary.